over to the prisoner. If Texas has its way, by the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Roberts by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, the 250th to be carried out under Governor Rick Perry. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorney Larry Douglas, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Professor Dennis Longmire, reporter at the hanging tree demonstration Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special interview guest Scott Cobb, director of the Texas Moratorium Network and a principal organizer of the annual March to Abolish the Death Penalty, scheduled this Saturday in Austin. The execution watch for Donnie Lee Roberts begins.
And this is Ray Hill. I am the usual host of Execution Watch. Tonight it's Donnie Roberts, and from midweek we've received emails from his friends and family saying that we should have no reason to expect any delays in his execution because there was nothing pending. I've got a reporter on the line. Hello, Professor, is that you?
Yes, Ray, this is me. Can you hear me?
I can hear you well. The Professor Dennis Longmire, who teaches at Criminal Justice School at Sam Houston University. What is going on there?
Okay, the witnesses for Donnie Lee have already gone in. They are just walking in the door right now. Donnie Roberts' witnesses have just entered. About a minute or so earlier than that, the witnesses for the media went in. And so there are clearly no more delays that should be expected. And it'll be interesting for everyone to mark their clocks to see how long it takes for the witnesses to come back out. With this new single drug protocol, it seems to be taking a little bit longer than it took with the three drug protocol.
Dennis, you want to speculate on what that actually means as far as Donnie Roberts is concerned?
Well, I mean, Donnie Roberts is on his way to his maker. He knows that, and whether it takes 19 minutes or 25 minutes doesn't really matter that much. I don't know whether it makes any difference in terms of their pain or discomfort. Of course, I don't think we will ever know that. I have noticed that since we've gone to the one-drug cocktail, more than one or two of the guys that are being executed have commented about feeling pain or a burning sensation immediately prior to becoming unconscious. And so there may be some level of pain that they're feeling that previously they would not have felt.
Yeah, that happened in the very last show that we did.
Yes.
Of course, we didn't know about it until the next morning when Grazik made point of it in his article.
Right. And, of course, we only know about it when one of the reporters writes about it. So that's what happened. It's kind of a morose day for us up here in Huntsville. Of course, it's Halloween, and everybody wants to celebrate that. I got a letter from Donnie Roberts a couple of days ago, and in that letter he commented that he now knew what he was going to be going as for Halloween, that he would be going as a corpse. Very poignant and sad statement. First of all, it shows that there is a little bit of a child still alive inside of him, that he would even think about Halloween in any way. And then that he is making his last day on Earth, the day of Halloween, is somewhat troubling in
Dennis,
some ways.
Dennis, are there other vigilants?
There are four of us here, and four regulars who are here very often. And so it's a very quiet night in terms of the vigil activity. This is one of the first times in a long time that I can remember when there have not been any people from the international community. And so that's often something that occurs, but tonight there is no one from that group here.
Thank you very much, Professor. Give the other vigilants our regards.
I sure will.
And if anything happens we should know about, feel free to call us quickly.
I will do that.
And I'm speculating that this is Gloria. Gloria, are you there?
This is Gloria, yes.
And how are things around the hanging tree?
Well, we are packing up here. We've been here for 2 hours. We had an incredible demonstration. It was both fun, beating the hell out of the Rick Perry pinata, and it was sad reading the names of 250 people that Perry has put to death, men and women.
I'm going to depend on you to speculate on the enormity of that figure.
It is so enormous that no governor in the United States of America will ever, ever get near it. It is so enormous that no state in this country has executed as many people as Rick Perry. The closest state to Texas is Virginia with 108 executions. Rick Perry is responsible for 250.
And the previous record was held by the previous governor.
152 for Bush.
152 for Bush, 250 for Rick Perry.
Yeah, and somebody came up today and they go, gosh, I guess nobody will ever get ahead of Bush. And I'm like, no, Perry is ahead of Bush.
Well,
so it is enormous. And we had people standing here reading the names who were family members and friends of those executed. And it was sad because Shaka Sankofa's three grandchildren were here reading these names. And they don't have a granddad.
No.
Carl Hampton, the leader of the Black Panther Party that was murdered by the Houston police, was here. Now, his dad was executed on the street, didn't even make it to Huntsville. And then Robert Muhammad was here, and he witnessed two executions, both of them of innocent men, Odell Barnes and Shaka Sankofa. Angie was here. Her friend Sam Bustamante was executed, and then I've witnessed two of my friends being executed. So, and also, you know, as the names were read, I knew a large number of these folks.
Because well, you probably know more of them than any of the rest of us, although I have certainly known a goodly number of people that have been executed. That's been over more than just this governorship. Of course, I don't know if you were listening, but Dennis Longmire reported the crossing of the road by the witnesses. So this process is in place.
Well, I knew that since the Supreme Court hadn't even considered this case, it was pretty unlikely anything would happen. But, you know, I think the enormity is incredible. Absolutely incredible. And Esther King's daughter read a page of names, and she said, you know, I've got goosebumps, and I didn't know these people. And I've never really been active against the death penalty, but I know that my dad was passionate about it. And just looking at these people and hearing these names, she says, I'm going to come on the bus Saturday and go to Austin.
Well, Gloria, our interview is with Scott Cobb, and he's going to tell us all about the Austin trip.
Okay, can I just say that the Houston bus will leave at 9 a.m. from Shape Center.
9 a.m. from Shape Center Saturday morning.
Right.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
And this is Dave Atwood. Dave, are you there?
I am, Ray. How are you doing?
Well, other than this gloomy occasion, I am doing well. And where are you?
We're at the corner of Almeda and Holcomb by the Dominican Sisters.
Okay, and you've got a crowd?
We've got about seven people out here. Not really a crowd, but a good group of steady protesters that are out here most weeks. And so it's a good turnout. We got our banner hung up on the fence here, so that's very visible. It says Stop Executions, Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. We have people here from, of course, the Texas Coalition, from the Methodist Church, Quakers, Catholics, and a few other varieties. So it's a good turnout, and as usual, we got a very good response here from many, many cars going by because hundreds of cars go by while we're out here.
That's at, is that the Dominican Sisters Convent?
Right, right.
Okay. And give my our regards to the other vigilants.
I will do.
And the process has begun, and now we have no idea when the time will be over.
Yeah,
so
I can't hear you. Can you speak up a little?
I said the process has begun, and with the new single chemical process, we have no idea when it'll be over.
Okay, all righty.
Thank you. Appreciate all that you do, Dave.
Well, Ray, we're seeing you know executions drop in this state and around the country, and we're seeing more and more countries abolish the death penalty. Even with the right-wing nature of this state, there's a lot of good people in this city and in this state that don't want this to happen anymore. And I'm just waiting for the time when we get the right people in power. So I would advise everybody to get out and vote because it makes a big difference.
Well, they only let me do that one time, but I've been schlepping other people to the polls.
Again, I couldn't hear you.
I said they only let me do that one time, but I've been schlepping other people to the polls. So.
Yeah, good.
Thank you, Dave.
All righty, you take care.
Bye-bye. And that was Dave Atwood, and Dave Atwood can be reached through www.tcadp.org. That's the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, tcadp.org. Before that was Gloria Ruback, abolitionmovement.org, abolitionmovement.org. And you can reach Professor Dennis Longmire through Sam Houston State University. It's easy to contact there. In the studio, we have lawyers, and our lawyers with microphones are Jim Skelton and Larry Douglas, and we have
Mike Gillespie.
Mike Gillespie in here. Now, we have got Jack Lee and Susan Ashley in the wings in case we wear out one of these lawyers and have to have them come in on an emergency basis. Who's going to do the...
I'll explain the facts.
Okay, what's fact?
What happened, Donnie Lee Roberts was a native of Louisiana, living in Natchitoches Parish, and he ended up getting on parole for a robbery case in Louisiana. Had kinfolks in Polk County, so he went to Polk County after he'd gotten released on parole. And while he was there, he met a lady by the name of Vicky Bowen in a bar. And they started a romantic relationship. They moved in together. During the time that Donnie Lee Roberts was living with her, he was addicted to alcohol as well as crack cocaine. And during the time he was employed, according to the testimony, he gave all of his money to her and they kind of shared expenses. And then when he was unemployed, apparently they had some relationship where she gave him $20 a day. And apparently they got into an argument over the $20 that he was supposed to get paid, given by her for that day's expenses. And he shot her in the head two times. After the shooting, he took some property of hers, a television set, some more items of hers, and stole her son's pickup. And then he was later found outside of a crack house with a pickup. He had pawned some of the stuff, traded some of the merchandise for crack cocaine. And then he confessed to the police. And when he confessed to the police, he admitted a murder some 12 years earlier. And also said something that ended up being very damaging. He received the death penalty. And what was interesting when I was reading this case, Ray, and it never dawned on me till I talked to Michael Gillespie, and Michael was wondering why in the world, because what made this a capital murder was a robbery aspect. Mm-hmm. And Michael was the one that brought, Michael, you have to get next to the phone, you can't rear back,
yeah,
next to the microphone. And what Michael brought up is, why wasn't there a common law marriage? Explain what you mean by that, Michael, why this wouldn't make it a capital murder.
Well, in the state of Texas, you don't have to be married by the government to be married. A marriage is an institution that two people decide that they're going to be married. And all it takes in Texas is to live together, to have a sexual relationship with, which is assumed if you're living together, and a holding out.
Holding out meaning explain
holding
that.
Holding out, it can be an introduction.
Well, holding out meaning they have to hold themselves out, husband and wife.
Okay. It's as simple as a well, this rock solid ones are a tax return, health insurance, a lease, buying a house together. When you do a legal document with your name and the woman's name, it's assumed that you're married. But it can be as simple as a birthday card, an anniversary card, a note to my wife, to my husband, an introduction to my wife, to my husband. In fact, the most famous case in Texas was Dave Winfield, the baseball player. Dave Winfield was living with a woman, and one day he went to school to pick up her children, and the teacher asked who he was. So he says, I'm her husband. That gave the woman millions of dollars in settlement because that was considered a holding out.
So what it basically takes is living together as husband and wife and holding yourself out as husband and wife. That's it, right?
That's all it takes.
But is there a difference between what is required for, like, quarreling over the money and in a criminal case?
That's what I was going to ask you. If assuming there was a common law marriage, would this have been an aggravated robbery if you took some of the property?
Well, the question becomes, if it's a common law marriage, then all assets are community assets owned by both parties. And so, therefore, you cannot take something that belongs to you. I've had scenarios where husbands have destroyed their wife's property and been arrested for criminal mischief. But it's not the wife's property, it's their property, and you can destroy your own property. There's no law against it. They'll try to get you on economic, but there's insurance on it. There's nothing they can do. Now, the funny thing about a common law marriage is that normally what makes a common law marriage golden is children. If there's a children relationship, the courts tend to bend over backwards to make that a common law marriage. But even with it's not children relationship, it's a fact issue. The other interesting fact is that the fact issue is got a burden of proof of civil law, which is a preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt. So that one issue is not a criminal issue. It's really a family court issue, which is a civil court issue. And all you have to find is more likely than not there was a common law marriage. The trouble with the world today is that people are not getting married. And every time in my practice, when a man ends up passing, every woman is coming out of the woodwork claiming, I'm the wife. And they all end up getting involved with it because all they need is their mother to say, he said that this is my wife. Their sister to say, this is my wife. That's all it takes in Texas.
And if you go to a family court, the issue is not whether the relationship exists, it's how do you divide the goodies?
Well, first, and that's a good question, Ray. The first thing to keep in mind is that with the ceremonial marriage, you have a marriage license, which means you're married because you have that license. When you don't have that marriage license, you have to go to court to prove to the judge the facts I just said. And if those facts are proven, then the judge finds that you're married. So you're not married till the judge finds it, but once he finds it, it's retroactive to the date.
Too much gobbledygook, Michael.
It is gobbledygook.
Anyway, the point is, here's what's interesting about this. Nobody, when I read the opinion, ever dawned on me they should have claimed common law marriage to knock the robbery aspect. Because remember what capital murder is.
Yes.
It's murder plus, and this is murder plus aggravated robbery. Had somebody been thinking like Michael, what they could have argued at the trial level is that they had a common law marriage. And as I understand Michael, all they would need to prove a common law marriage is someone to come forward saying that he introduces my husband or wife. And that would be sufficient to get the issue to the jury. That would have knocked the robbery out, and that would have knocked out the capital murder charge. Well, what's interesting, Ray, this was never brought up at trial. It was never brought up in any of the appeals. First time I ever thought about it is when I talked to Michael about it.
When we come back, we're going to discuss what actually happened in that trial, not this wonderful idea that has come up around the table, apparently a little bit late, but we will be discussing that. But right now, we're going to put on Scott Cobb. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi.
You are the director of the Texas Moratorium Network, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And you have an event coming up concerning the issue. You want to talk about it?
Yeah, we're having our annual march to abolish the death penalty this Saturday, November 3rd. It starts at 2 p.m. at the Texas Capitol in Austin. And this is the 13th year we've been doing it. We had the first one back in 2000. And it was a couple of months before Rick Perry became governor. And as you know, today was his 250th execution under Rick Perry. So it's been a long 12 years, and there's been a lot of developments in the efforts to stop executions or to to decrease them, but we feel that we're making some progress, and we want to have a good turnout on Saturday so that we can show, you know, people who don't think there are a lot of opposition to the death penalty in Texas that they're wrong, and people are changing their opinions about the death penalty. And we're moving towards a day, depending on what happens in some other states like California, where there is going to be no death penalty in Texas.
Well, I don't know. Tell us something about the organization, TexasMoratorium.org. Tell us about that organization. How's it structured? What is its goals and aspirations?
Well, we got started actually also back around the first March to Abolish Death Penalty back in 2000. And we are in favor of ending the death penalty, and we think that the means to do that in Texas, and we've seen that in other states, is to first establish a moratorium on executions. If you look at the states that have moved towards abolition or gotten close to it, those are states that have gone through either an official moratorium or a de facto moratorium where they didn't really have any executions in the first place, like New Jersey. And then you have Illinois, of course, with their official moratorium. And if you look where in California right now, they've had no executions. They've had a de facto moratorium since 2006. So I think it's important, and our organization takes this opinion, position, that in order to reach abolition, you have to first get to a point where there aren't any executions, because it's so embedded in the policymakers. They're so you know, attached to the death penalty that first they have to go through a period where there aren't any executions. They can't just go from a state like in Texas where one year you have, you know, 15, 17, 20 executions every single year, year in, year out, and then you suddenly choose to abolish the death penalty. I think that first, if you get those yearly executions down to, you know, from their current rate up to 20, you know, 15, 20, whatever it is, down to like below 10, and then you have a moratorium where there's absolutely no executions, that establishes the space for dialogue where people can discuss it on the level of the legislature in their communities, and they can look around and say, okay, there's nobody being executed like right now. Let's look at the system and see whether or not we need to, you know, continue with the death penalty or whether we can abolish it as it has been done in some other states.
I have attended a couple of the marches in Austin, and what struck me immediately was the diversity of the people there.
Absolutely.
It looked to me like a reflection of death row itself. There are a lot of folks there who are black. There are a lot of Hispanic folks. There are, of course, mostly poor people. So the demonstration itself seems to look like the cast on death row. And I don't know if that's just an incidental thing that happens or that's where these folks come from.
Well, the people who are interested in the issue of the death penalty, we find, are the people who turn out for rallies and events, are people who have a connection to someone on death row or family member, or they come from communities where they see people wrongfully sentenced to various terms in prison, not just the death penalty, but, you know, in some neighborhoods where you have people disproportionately going off to prison, you know, and leaving behind a big vacuum in the neighborhood of males of a certain age, and those are the people who are concerned about the criminal justice system, and they tend to come out to events like this event on Saturday, in higher proportion than numbers who, the people who maybe live in more affluent neighborhoods. So we need to, you know, have a discussion with the more affluent neighborhoods where, unfortunately, they have more political power, you know, traditionally. So we need to get more of them involved, and so that they can, you know, help us move the issue along as far as the legislature's concerned.
Now, this is a march, so you kind of gather across the bridge on the south side of Town Lake and come up Congress Avenue to the Capitol building. Is that still
What we're going to be doing is we used to start a different location and march to the Capitol. We found it a lot more efficient if we start at the Capitol and then we go through downtown Austin and come around the governor's mansion for a brief stop outside the gates of the governor's mansion and then end up back at the Capitol. So it's a march, it's a rally, it's a march through downtown, and but the starting and the stopping point is the Texas Capitol.
Okay.
So people could just go to the Capitol.
And those are the south steps.
Yes, the south side of the Capitol, the street where side where Congress on 11th Street is.
And the stop at the governor is going to have a little more meaning this time because of the proliferation of executions in Texas during this governor's term.
Exactly. This is the first year in several years where Rick Perry has moved back into the governor's mansion. Last year, last years, it's been closed because of a fire and the renovation. And so now we can stop there and maybe he'll be inside. Who knows if he's out doing something or not. But, you know, in the past, last year, we stopped out there and it was still under construction. So it is a little bit going to be a kind of a powerful moment when we get out there and know that somebody's in there. I remember back in 2000, I believe, yeah, it was 2000, we stopped by there and we knew that, George Bush was inside there. And I think some of the people inside of the mansion came out and we would see them out there back then. So when there's people in there, then it's a very emotional moment when people stand outside on the streets communicating with, you know, the chief executive of the state of Texas.
And Gloria mentioned that there will be a bus from Shape Center Saturday morning from about 9 o'clock headed for Austin. Do you know of any other areas of the state where there's group activities to get there?
Well, there's group activity, not exactly a bus, but there's groups coming from San Antonio that we know of. Those are, I believe, people from associated with the ACLU, and they were ACLU was also helping with the buy some tickets with the Houston bus. So we always get a lot of turnout from Houston and San Antonio. San Antonio's because it's so close, I guess. But people come from all over, and every year there's, you know, some people who come to it from other states and from European countries. One of the speakers is the wife of Hank Skinner this year, Sandrine Skinner. So she'll be coming from France. She's, you know, going to do a visit with Hank and then come to the rally. But, yeah, we've seen people from all over Texas and other parts of the country.
Anyone listening that has never attended only needs to show up, right?
Yeah, just show up. You know, we're going to have some signs. If you don't bring your own, you know, you're certainly encouraged and, you know, to make your own sign and express your own opinion. But, you know, we'll have some for people to carry if they don't bring in anything. And it's going to be an exciting day, and we hope that people come out to it and that they go back home afterwards, you know, re-energize and say, after listening to the speakers, there'll be various speakers of people, family members of people on death row currently, some people exonerated former death row survivors, former prisoners on death row who will be there. And so you hear these stories and you go back to wherever they live in Houston or Dallas or whatever, and then take those stories to people in their own communities and organize events and invite people to come out to those events. That's how we're going to, you know, build the movement is on the local level. And then, you know, once a year there's this big rally in the Capitol, but it's back at home where people really make a difference. And that's what we hope they do. They come to the rally and then they go home and start spreading the word.
As we're broadcasting this, I look over in the adjacent studio where I see Maida Asofsky of the ACLU. She is perhaps preparing an announcement of a similar nature for the ACLU show here on KPFD between now and the end of the week. So,
yeah, we are excited that we contacted them and they agreed to be a co-sponsor of the march. So they're, you know, we're very happy that they're involved this year.
Scott, I hope to see you Saturday, and thank you for being a part of Execution Watch.
All right, well, thank you for having me.
Yes, sir. Bye-bye. And that was Scott Cobb, and you can find out more information about Scott, his activity, and what's going on in the march and things by getting in touch with him through www.texasmoratorium.org. I want to caution you that we could get word from Huntsville any minute, and I see a flashing light. Professor? That's not Professor? Okay, I'm sorry. Put that on. Okay, so we're awaiting a call from Huntsville, but that could come at any time. So now we're back to the discussion of what happened in this trial. Larry, you can take lead on this one?
Well, this trial, like so many capital murder cases, the most hotly contested portion of the trial was the punishment phase, the guilt-innocence phase. I mean, we have a situation where Donnie Lee Roberts confessed to killing Vicki Bowen. Now, the whole issue about whether that was a an aggravated robbery or not, that was contested to some degree. But again, we've mentioned earlier that the common law marriage issue was not brought up, but he did confess to asking her for money and then shooting her. So he was found guilty of capital murder. So the issue becomes life or death. And so at that stage, the concerns or the issue is, the life or death decision is based on deliberate act, future dangerousness, and mitigation. So that's really where the contested issues were.
How long ago was this trial?
The event occurred back in when was this? The date of the offense was October 15th, 03. So it has not been,
it's not been
that
years.
Long ago at all. One of the things that happens in the penalty phase is that their expert testimony can be admitted for the purpose of mitigation and in this case, and in the case of Donnie Roberts, well, the good thing about expert testimony is experts can testify as to their opinion under certain circumstances. So in this case, Donnie Roberts had a doctor, a medical doctor, who sought to give testimony, and the essence of her testimony is that the murder would not have occurred had it not been for the fact that he was diagnosed with having both alcohol and cocaine dependency, and there was alcohol and cocaine both in his system. She was not allowed to testify to that. Now, when an expert is to come forward and give an opinion, what the court seeks to do is to have them determine certain reliability requirements. And so the judge conducted a gatekeeper hearing to see what's going to come in and what's not going to. The doctor was allowed to testify that Donnie Roberts had a cocaine dependency problem and an alcohol dependency problem, and that a person with those two dependency issues, if they have those substances in their system at the time, they tend to have more violent tendencies. That evidence did get in. But when they sought to elicit the testimony that it would not have occurred but for those two factors being involved. Now, there were issues regarding whether she was trying to establish a causal connection or a correlation between the two. But when the judge heard the testimony at trial, at the gatekeeper hearing, the judge made the judgment call that, well, this much can come in. That is, you can talk about increased violence and an increased tendency to be violent, but the judge did not allow the doctor to testify that but for, even though the doctor says, I'm not trying to establish a causal connection, just a correlation.
Okay, the judges have that kind of discretion. Is that normal?
Let me tell you what really I complain. I'm going to go back to what Michael had said earlier and make sure we understand it, what I call gobbledygook. Let's kind of boil it down. It's understanding, Michael, you can have two type of marriages in Texas, ceremonial marriage where a preacher or a JP does it, and you can have a marriage that's common law. Both of them are considered valid, correct?
They're both identical, just how they're formed.
Okay.
One's formed by the government.
I'm saying that. Okay, well, we got the two marriages, but common law marriages, and all it takes to raise the issue is for if this lady had introduced him as her husband or he introduced his wife, that'd be all they need need to raise the issue, right?
More interesting, who's there to
Well, I'm just saying.
Right, all the Texas.
So that could have been easily raised at this trial.
He could have said it.
Okay, let me go back to what Larry was talking about. Let me tell you what I'm really furious about in this case. Number one, this opinion is written by Sharon Keller, who's the chief judge of the Court of Criminal Appeals, and it's extremely hypocritical. Let me tell you why. Because they permitted this doctor, as a medical doctor, and part of the reason they said he couldn't testify is that she was not reliable. If she was not reliable, they should have excluded everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what they basically said, she was reliable enough to talk about the fact she'd done experimenting showing that people who had a dual addiction of cocaine and alcohol would tend to be violent. She was permitted to say that Donnie Lee had a dual addiction, but she wasn't permitted to say, in my opinion, had it not been for the dual addiction, this murder would never have occurred. If she's reliable enough to say the former, why couldn't she say the latter? That is absolutely stupid, because if she's not reliable, they should have excluded everything and not cherry-pick what she could get into evidence. I find that highly, highly offensive, because if reliability is really the issue, how can she be reliable enough to say, I've done all these experiments and studying on the dual combination of alcoholism and cocaine. It makes people violent. And then this guy has that dual addiction. And all she could say then, in my opinion, had it not been for his addiction, this murder would never have occurred. That's what they excluded, saying that wasn't reliable. Well, if that's not reliable, why would the former really? It's stupid. It's right. Absolutely hypocritical. And it's typical Sharon Keller. And I'm furious. That, to me, is just offensive. If it's reliability is the issue, Keller, none of it should have come in.
Sharon Keller didn't come to that conclusion by herself. She's got to have some support.
Well, the trial judge, the problem is, and everybody knows that, trial judges have a lot of pressure. This is a guy from outside of the state. Mm-hmm. A local person is killed. Trial judges have to get elected. They're going to go with the state. We all know that.
Yeah.
But you expect appellate judges to be more objective about it and more fair about it. This is absolutely stupid to say that she's not reliable. If she's not reliable, she shouldn't have testified, period. And if she is reliable, they should have let her come to the conclusion. So that's why I find highly offensive about that particular aspect of the case.
Well, the only thing about that, Jim, and I agree with you, but the way the court justifies its position is the claim that when she sought to talk about the correlation, the but-for correlation, then they started to pressure on whether there were any studies or treatises or statistics that she could quote. And when she wasn't able to do that, I mean, they say, well, you know, is it published in any kind of publication?
They wanted to exclude everything she said.
And I have no idea whether there was any support in terms of the correlation for increased violent tendencies. But when she tried to get to the ultimate issue, which as Jim pointed out, the court lets the expert testimony exclude certain expert testimony, particularly for defense. But the defendant's concern was all the other experts could testify as to the ultimate issue. That is, the experts for the state could testify as to the ultimate issue, but not the expert for the defense.
Because my complaint is they cherry-picked what they let her say.
Can you tell from the record that the trial lawyer tried everything that he or she was supposed to try?
In terms of trying to get the expert, there was quite a bit of information on the gatekeeper hearing.
And explain what gatekeeper is. They have people in the audience.
Well, the judge's discretion.
Gatekeeper hearing is when they have a hearing outside the jury's presence and test their qualifications.
Right.
That's what's called a gatekeeper hearing, and that testimony is not admitted in front of the jury. It's a hearing outside the jury's presence. That's what they call
a
gatekeeper
hearing.
Then
the judge decides what the jury can hear.
Exactly.
The judge decides whether or not that witness is reliable and whether her information is reliable.
And in this case, the judge decided that this witness was reliable in part and not reliable.
Reliable enough to talk about her studies, but not reliable enough to say there was a connection between his addiction and the murder.
So, doesn't that essentially mean that the judge is cherry picking the information?
That's what I said. Exactly. That's my whole point.
And it's hard to stretch qualified here and not qualified there into any cohesive pattern.
Because when they say reliability is why she couldn't testify, then she shouldn't have testified, period, and not cherry-pick what she said, because the state's expert, they didn't cherry-pick their testimony. And that's what I'm mad about in this opinion.
Well, how did the appeals work out?
There, you want to talk about that metadata. Another thing I'm furious about, and go ahead and talk about it, is that victim impact testimony and the mitigation part.
Okay, victim impact testimony is oftentimes used in these kinds of cases in terms of what impact does it have on the victim. This is a capital murder.
She did.
And so that is the victim impact information you would expect to have in this kind of case would be Vicki Boyne's relatives, friends, what have you.
Let's talk about, and I'm talking about the extraneous defense, Larry.
Right, right. But rather than have it talk about Vicki Boyne's, the objectionable one, seemingly objectionable, was that there was another victim, a victim of another offense. That is, at the time he was on parole for an armed robbery, they brought the victim of the armed robbery in. So it had nothing to do with the capital murder. The victim of the armed robbery came in and testified as to the impact that the armed robbery had on her, saying that she couldn't go back to work anymore, that she was frightened that she was going to be robbed. All of that testimony did come in. Now Roberts raised the issue of the testimony came in without objection. And so Roberts's position on appeal was that my attorney was ineffective for the failure to object to that extraneous, the victim impact information on the extraneous. But that was pretty strange to have that kind of testimony, testimony of an offense that he was not on trial for here to come in. And the court justified saying, well, it should come in, and besides, your lawyer didn't object to it.
Let me explain the hypocrisy of that. That department, and this is really just, it's an offense. In fact, the dissenting opinion pointed this out. As a general rule in a capital murder case, they will let in prior convictions. So what happened, they not only brought over, you need to answer the phone.
Yes, line. I think this is our report from Huntsville. Professor?
Yes, I just want to let you all know that the witnesses are now proceeding out of the walls unit, which means that the execution is over. Literally, as I'm watching, Donnie Roberts' witnesses are crossing the street going back into the main administration building.
42 minutes after they crossed before.
Yes, and if you'll recall, Ray, it used to be 15 minutes.
And 20 at the most.
Yeah, 20 at the most. So something is different, that's for sure.
Yeah, I don't know who is the person to analyze what this means. I know that I'm not qualified, but it sounds ominous to me.
Yes, myself as well.
Thank you, Professor. We appreciate your keeping us informed.
Okay.
And I told people they can get in contact with you through Sam Houston State University. What department?
College of Criminal Justice.
Thank you, sir.
Sure thing.
So, Donnie Roberts is now dead, and what happens is that the funeral home, the contractor is Carnes Funeral Home, will put him on a gurney, take him out of there, and carry him to a nearby church, and the family members will be able to go and touch him while there's still warmth in the body for the first time since he was locked up on death row almost 9 years ago.
Let me tell you what I was, how hypocritical this holding is on the particular extraneous offense. Let me explain. In a capital murder case at punishment, you can let in prior convictions from prior acts of misconduct. In this case, normally they may call a complaint and say, you robbed me. But in this case, not only did they go through the robbery, they played the video of the robbery itself. There was a videotape. They retried the robbery case again. Now, you had a case called Cantu, in which they reversed the case because the mother of a extraneous offense testified as to the impact that had on her life. And they reversed that case. You know how they distinguished this one? They said the difference is, in this case, it wasn't the mother. It was the actual victim who testified. Therefore, the victim impact evidence was admissible. Let me repeat that again. In the Cantu case, a mother who had been killed by Cantu, a different defendant, the different deceased person in the case Canty was on trial for as an extraneous murder, testified as the impact it had on her. They ruled that to be inflammatory and reversed the case. In this case, they said Canty is not applicable because it's not the mother telling about the impact, but it's the victim herself. What difference does it make?
You're right.
Victim impact evidence is victim impact evidence.
Doesn't that kind of stuff go to a higher court than Texas Court of Criminal Appeals?
Court of Criminal Appeals is the highest court. Don't forget, in the state.
But then you got to depend on the Supreme Court, who is very busy, and it does not interest it because its effects on.
Well, as I told the writ lawyer, here's the problem we've got. We got Sharon Keller, who's a horrible judge who heard this case, who wrote the opinion in this case, and then from there you've got to go to the Eastern District of Texas, who's a federal writ, and you've got to go to the Fifth Circuit. None of which are considered very liberal. But that's hypocritical because if you have an extraneous offense admitted at punishment, extraneous means an offense other than the one they're trying him for, then you let the mother, saying the mother can't testify about the impact of that crime, that's admissible. Then if you say the victim can testify, what's the difference? Victim impact evidence.
Let me get this straight.
Evidence.
Okay, well, that was the issue of the excessive information about the extraneous offense at the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. How do we know that that issue was even raised in the federal courts?
They raised it both at the federal level. They raised it in the writ for this. They read it in the federal writ, and they raised it in the post-conviction writs. But the court, they all flushed it.
But there's nothing carved in stone that you even have to talk about the same stuff.
No.
Whenever you move, you've got, what, a little broader category of things you can talk about in the writ process than in the direct
appeal? Not really, because see what happens. Here's what's kind of foolish about it. Sharon Keller writes the opinion. She's the Chief Justice. When you come back on a post-conviction writ, it goes back to the same court who issued the opinion to begin with. You're not getting much of a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you go to the federal courts, they ask the following question. They don't review what the state courts have done. What they basically ask, although we may not agree with what the state court has done, is that an unreasonable application of federal law? If it's an application to state law, they won't consider
it. It's not theirs. It's not their business.
That's right. So it's not really a review in federal court. It really is not a review.
No,
so the real critical thing is what judge you draw that writes your opinion. And to me, that is absolutely, because it was a dissenting opinion. Judge Myers, Johnson, and Price dissented on that issue, pointing out the same thing I pointed out. If victim impact evidence is not admissible at a punishment hearing, then it makes no difference the vehicle, whether it's the mother saying or the victim saying, is still the same. And I agree with the dissenting opinion completely. But unfortunately, they've got three judges that voted against it.
Am I wrong for being a little bit uncomfortable with the idea that there are several different avenues that could have been taken, either at the trial level or in the appellate level, who makes these decisions of which option you go with?
The defense lawyer. But what I think is the only way I default the defense lawyer is what Michael pointed out. To me, that is a critical issue that was overlooked. In fact, it never dawned on me when I was reading this opinion until I talked to Michael about it. The first thing Michael popped
in his head. Now that it's on the table, it's rather obvious.
And it's real obvious at this point.
Kind of sticks out.
It's real obvious. Now, that's I can only, because you can't. The only way you can't fault the lawyer very much, except perhaps overlooking that. The fact is, as Larry pointed out, you got a confession. He admits it. In fact, when he's caught outside of a crack house driving the car, or the victim's son's car, and he had some of the property, too, and they could trace all that to him, plus he had a confession. So your conviction's going to be assured. The question is, if he had proven that there was a common law marriage, this would not have been a capital murder. They could have got a lesser included defense. Even if they'd have raised the issue, Michael, correct me, they could have submitted murder as a lesser included defense as opposed to capital murder.
Correct, yeah.
Is that right, Michael?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I just think, first of all.
Well, and you know that. And the other thing that bothers me is that this is the second case in a row where we've had some hanky panky with the expert witness.
I find that cherry picking just drives me nuts. I mean, I just think that's so wrong. And one thing I do want to mention too, and we've not talked about this. Earlier during the week, I was contacted with some people from Europe who've been in contact with Donnie Roberts.
Okay.
I've never personally met him. And I talked to them at some length, and they asked me to about some issues that we had discussed on this program.
Sure.
I then, in turn, contacted the lawyer who was handling the appeal, a very nice man named Doug Barlow in Beaumont. He did as good a job as you could possibly do with what he had to work with, and I talked to him. He even had the record reviewed by a University of Texas professor to make sure he hadn't covered everything. And then today I got another phone call from this same family in Europe, and I can't pronounce her name. It's somewhere in Europe. And they told me a great deal about Donnie Lee Roberts. Number one, they wanted to make sure that the listening audience knew the following. He has been a very, very good, loving father to his son. He's had absolutely no discipline problems while he's on death row. He's not bothered anybody. He has a loving family. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I found really offensive about this case, during the punishment hearing, they permitted the family of Vicki Bowen to come and testify, 71-year-old father, mm-hmm. her mother, and her son. Both of them cried and talked about the horror that the death meant to them. Now, what the defense tried to do, the defense tried to call Donnie Lee's niece. And Donnie Lee's niece explained that when she was growing up, Donnie Lee lived in a horrible condition, was raised by his grandparents, mm-hmm. that he was like a father to her, took care of her, played with her, was very nice to her. When she got to be older, he helped her fix up her house, helped take care of her. She wanted to testify about the impact the death sentence would have on her life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember, we got three family members that come forward and talk about the impact of the victim's death on them. To balance that off, they wanted to have some of the Donnie Lee's family talk about the impact the death penalty would have on them. Guess what happened? Guess what happened? As soon as she's going to say the impact, now here's what's really chicken. As soon as she's going to say what impact the death would have on her, there was an objection that was not relevant. The trial judge sustained it. Now, when that goes up on appeal, and this is really hypocritical, you know what Keller ruled?
Mm-mm.
Error was waived. You know why she said error was waived? Because when a judge excludes evidence, you normally have to put that evidence in the record by way of what we call a bill of exception. And since he didn't put into evidence what this niece would have said, then they said he waived error. But here's what's funny. Everybody knows what she would have said.
Sure.
I mean, it's just stupid because the purpose of that rule theoretically is if the judge makes a ruling to exclude evidence, you got to have something in the record to show what the evidence would have been so the appellate court can determine whether that's right or wrong. You could tell by the tenor of the questioning ahead of time
sure.
what she would have said. And for that, for Keller to say he waived error on that point is barbaric. Because once she testified about all the kind things this man had done for her, you know damn good and well what she's going to say when it comes to the point about the impact the death would have on her. You know that. And for them to say, well, the trial lawyer waived error but not putting into evidence what she would have said had she got a chance to speak, you could tell from the questions what she would have said.
Yeah.
And I found this highly offensive.
Actually, well, Jim, that's probably the most offensive thing about this whole case.
Disgusting.
Is the excluding the evidence and the reason for justifying saying that they waived the error.
The color rubber stamping of that authorization.
Because that evidence really should have come in. If you're going to have victim impact.
You know, we've got an election coming up in about 6 days.
And don't forget Sharon Kelly, Ray. Don't forget to tell the audience she was the one.
5 o'clock closes the court.
Well, let me explain that's even more egregious than that. What happens whenever there is an execution pending, they assign one of the judges to be there late in case the last minute something is filed. Some time ago, the judge that was assigned to be there late was Judge Johnson. And Judge Johnson is considered one of the more fair-minded judges.
Mm-hmm.
What happened, the lawyers that were defending this particular defendant who was scheduled for execution, their computer had broken down, and they could not get their writ into the Court of Criminal Appeals by 5 o'clock. So they called the clerk to ask the clerk if they could hold the office open until 6 o'clock where they get their computer running, get the writ filed. Rather than the clerk calling Judge Johnson, who was the one assigned, they instead called Sharon Keller at home. And she said, close the office at 5 o'clock. They haven't got it ready by then. Tough luck. That's then they executed the guy.
And that made a big case.
Well, she got disciplined by the Judicial Qualifications Commission for it.
Well, what you've been listening to is Execution Watch on this Halloween Eve, which began with a very appropriate laugh with a guy with all the voice. And in the process, Donnie Roberts died. And we do this every time Texas goes to kill someone. Tonight, I want to thank Michael Gillespie for joining us, and, of course, Jim Skelton and Larry Douglas. I want to thank Scott Cobb for joining us via phone from Austin about the march, which is coming up this coming Saturday. Professor Dennis Longmire is a reliable vigilant in Huntsville, and we appreciate the bad news that he brought, that witnesses were crossing the road one direction, and the worst news that he brought, that the witnesses were returning from that direction. Thank Gloria Ruback for having the stamina to go down to the hanging tree and commemorate the 250th execution by Governor Rick Perry. Dave Atwood, the vigilant out at the Dominican Sisters Convent, waving at passersby and reminding them that execution is not a good idea. Of course, Donnie Roberts will not return to the row where his friends have been listening to us tonight. I want to thank you fellows on the row for listening to Execution Watch. We couldn't be able to do that if it weren't for Elizabeth Stein, our wonderful producer. Studio engineer is Doyle. In the background, you hear Victoria Panetti's Monster. You can find out about her at SheMonster.com/MySpace. SheMonster. My name is Ray Hill. Execution Watch is completed. Thank you for listening. Next execution scheduled for November the 8th is Mario Swain. Unless a stay, there will be a broadcast. Jesus' name.